All right, again, Uhuru, good morning. Uhuru is a Swahili word that means freedom, and so we want to make sure that that's always on our lips when we greet each other. So, Uhuru, brothers and sisters and comrades. Welcome to the International Conference of the Coalition for Bread, Peace, and Black Power. My name is Aisha Cleary, and I'm the Secretary of the Black is Back Coalition. On today and tomorrow, we will be participating in our third international conference since our founding on September 12, 2009. Our first conference was held in St. Petersburg, Florida in January of 2010, and our second was held in Washington, D.C. on March 26th of last year. Since our 2009 founding, our coalition has been very busy and has conducted some groundbreaking events. Our founding was not only necessitated by the election of Barack Obama, but more importantly, by the times. Like now, the U.S. imperialist wars abounded, and there was not a quality response to those wars and the related hardships being experienced by our people. We resisted the definition of war and peace by the traditional peace movements that did not include the conditions being posed on African people around the world and the right here within the borders of the U.S. We rejected an anti-war movement that could not recognize the ongoing war against the indigenous peoples within the U.S. that includes the so-called Indians, corralled in concentration camps called reservations, on their own land, as well as the Mexicans who have been separated and impoverished by the theft of half of Mexico by the U.S. We want peace, but we do not want a George Bush or Barack Obama peace. We do not accept an imperialist peace as a viable solution. On November 7, 2009, the Black is Back Coalition held the first national anti-war rally, march, and demonstration against the Obama administration at the White House in D.C., in Washington, D.C. In January 2010, we conducted our first international conference and followed that by a national march in Miami in solidarity with the struggles of our brothers and sisters in Haiti following the devastating earthquake there. In November of 2010, we held two national demonstrations with Haiti as a main focus, one in D.C. that included a march on the White House and the other a week later in Harlem at the office of a former U.S. President, Bill Clinton, demanding U.S. out of Haiti and Clinton out of Harlem. In March of 2011, our second international conference was held in Washington, D.C. under the theme of National Conference Against the Other Wars. The other wars are all those wars against our people and others that are not commonly recognized by the traditional peace and anti-war movement. A resolution from that conference led to a resolution calling for an International Day of Action against the other wars against Africa and African people. This resulted in demonstrations and other actions occurring on August 20th, 2011, from Nassau in the Bahamas, Philadelphia, D.C., St. Petersburg, Florida, London, England, as well as an assortment of cities throughout Europe. This year's conference is entitled Obama, the Elections and the Struggle for Peace, Justice, a Better Way of Life, and Black Power. It is a conference that is obviously influenced by the fact that there is a presidential election right around the corner, and the current president, Barack Obama, is fighting for another term as leader of the imperialist world. Wars and economic crisis are the order of the day, and most people have approached election season affected by this reality. As for our own community, we are also concerned with the growing police militarization of our communities, mass incarceration of our people, and economic quarantine that results in social havoc. Our children are being brutalized and kicked out of schools that function primarily as indoctrination centers and a pipeline to prisons. This is a part of the reality that confronts us as we convene this important conference today. While this conference will obviously examine the role of Barack Obama as U.S. president and his impact on our struggle, it is our intent to do much more than that. The coalition wants to look at the historical relationships of elections to our struggle and the role of elections in capitalist society itself. We want to take this discussion beyond an examination of Obama to an examination of the electoral process itself. We also want you, participants of this conference who are not already members of the Black is Back Coalition, Black is Back Coalition, to join today. The call to join will be occurring throughout the conference, and conference organizers will be constantly confronting you with this call. This is because we are convinced that our success in overcoming our current conditions will depend primarily on the level of organization we achieve as a people. Our agenda is extremely tight, so the coalition is calling on everyone to exercise maximum discipline to help us get through the agenda within the allotted time. The first day of the conference will deal primarily with a discussion suggested by the theme. On the second day, tomorrow, we will be concentrated on the business of the coalition, consolidating our organization by filling out the structure of our steering committee. Brothers and sisters, I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the fact that this conference is occurring on the birthday anniversary of Marcus Garvey, a most important leader of our struggle. Uhuru. A most important leader of our struggle, who was born in Jamaica on August 17, 1887. 125 years later, his influence is obvious to so many of us, and his name is increasingly used to justify all manner of sometimes contradictory belief, actions, and inactions. Please join me in calling his name in remembrance of his great works, contributions, and sacrifices for Africa and African people. Uhuru. Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey. Uhuru. I would also like to call for a moment. I would also like to call for a moment of silence in memory of one of the founding members of the coalition, who held the post of the fundraising coordinator until her untimely death on March 23rd of this year. Sister Queen Ya Asantewaa, also known as Dorothy Lewis. A moment of silence. Uhuru. Before moving forward with the conference, I would like to introduce the current members of the Coalition Steering Committee, and if they are in the room, I would like them to stand once their names are announced. As I mentioned earlier, I am Aisha Fleary, the Coalition Secretary. Our website coordinator is Rich Piedrahita. There he is in the back. Oseno Mbenga is our treasurer. Is he in the room? He's not here yet. Our media working group coordinator is Chara Walker of the Bahamas, who is not in attendance. Recruitment coordinator is Ifia Nwangaza, also not present today. Glenn Ford has functioned as our research coordinator. Glenn, could you stand? Thank you. And the deceased Queen Mother Ya Asantewaa, also known as Dorothy Lewis, was our fundraising coordinator. I would also call on you to help me welcome our guest, Ron Gochez. Comrade Ron Gochez is a member of Union del Barrio, a Mexican national liberation organization that has long befriended our struggle and that brought a solidarity message to our March 26, 2011 conference in Washington, D.C. If Brother Ron can stand up and be recognized. The coalition has asked Compañero Ron, who is running for a city council seat in Los Angeles, California, to be here today. We thought Ron's participation in the conference is not only important for the unity of the struggles of our two peoples, but also because they face so many of the same issues and questions regarding electoral politics that his participation will contribute to our need to discover the universality located in our particular struggles as African people. Uhuru. Thank you so much. So as we move forward into the agenda, I would like to just make a few announcements. Is Chairman Larry Ham here? Lawrence Ham? Not yet. Okay. Got it. So at the end of each of the presentations that we're going to be have here today, we're going to ask that our presenters think about resolutions that can be introduced. We will have 15 minutes at the end of the presentations. We've allotted that in the time frame to discuss the resolutions that will be presented to the steering committee for a vote on tomorrow. So at this time, I would like to introduce Larry Adams, who is the Vice Chair of the People's Organization for Progress, as in place of Chairman Lawrence Ham. Uhuru.
Thank you, sister.
You're welcome.
Uhuru. Sasa. Now. Sisters and brothers, forgive me. This is impromptu. I wasn't scheduled to give the welcome, but I am honored on this occasion of the third International Conference of the Black Hispanic Movement to welcome sisters and brothers and comrades in struggle to the city of Newark. Y'all all been here long enough to know that Newark has a rich history of struggle and has played very important parts in the freedom struggle of our people and the advancement of the struggle of emancipation of all people. Because through the struggle in Newark, we've learned many lessons. Newark has a big long history of national resistance, by becoming a majority black city, and black people saying we're sick and tired of being sick and tired, of getting beat up, by being abused, in the 1967 stage, one of the most historic rebellions against national oppression in this city. Newark has a long history of student struggle, where our chairperson, in fact, as a result of that struggle, became the youngest Board of Education member in the country when he was like 17 years old. Newark has a history of now three sequential black mayors. We have a Nat Turner Park. We have streets named after various Afro-American and we had a Marcus Garvey memorial. And so we have many symbols and trappings of the African-American presence in this city. But we also have an excess of 20% unemployment. We also still suffer under police brutality, but now the cops are black. We vanguarded in many ways the struggle demands that were raised in the past history of our, in the past period of our struggle of fighting for more black cops, for black mayors, and that those being thought to be symbols of power. Well, that's what they are. They've proven to be symbols of power because our people are poorer than they were at the time of the modern civil rights movement. Unemployment is higher, although there's a lot of new housing. We don't own too much of it. So that we are, while there are symbols, there is no real power being held by the Afro-American people in this majority black town. Prudential Insurance Company still owns Newark. So where does that take us? That takes us to the reality, to the realization that this and many other meetings and gatherings of forces like this are necessary and appropriate. And that those of you who have come to bring your spirit of resistance to join with ours and hopefully build united fronts of resistance are very welcomed, because we need each other's strength and inspiration. There's much work to be done. We have to continue to build the resistance to imperialist wars at home and abroad. And Pop, on behalf of People's Organization for Progress and our chairperson, I give you a warm welcome, spirit of solidarity, and for truly, black is back. Let's unite with that slogan. Let's stop the wars at home and aboard and build the resistance. Welcome to Newark, y'all. Let's fight.
Thank you so much, comrade. We appreciate that welcome. So before I introduce our next speaker, I do want to just make another announcement to all of the presenters that are currently here. We have a timekeeper, and he will be holding up a sign. That will be comrade Rich Piedrahita in the green Black is Back shirt. And just please make sure that you take notice of that as you come up. Next, delivering our political report to the conference is our chairman, Omalia Chitella, Chairman of the Black is Back Coalition and the African People's Socialist Party. Chairman Omali founded the Burning Spear newspaper, which we currently have over there at the African People's Socialist Party table, and leads the African Socialist International with branches throughout the Americas, Europe, and Africa. He founded the Uhuru Movement, which publicly challenged candidate Obama in a campaign stop in 2008, demanding, "What about the black community, Obama?" His report to the conference is expected to discuss the impact of Obama and to propose a way forward for the African community. It will be followed by a discussion and adoption of the report. Uhuru. Chairman Omali Yeshitele.
Uhuru. Uhuru. Does this work from here?
One more announcement. I'm sorry. There was an adjustment to the agenda. If you all have one, lunch is now scheduled to start at 1 o'clock. So we just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that. Okay.
Uhuru. I want to thank Secretary Aisha Fleury for that introduction, and I would also like to express my deep, most profound appreciation to Vice Chair Larry Adams for representing Comrade Chairman Larry Ham and the People's Organization for Progress at this important conference. I would also like to express the recognition that we of the Black is Back Coalition have for the incredibly significant work of the People's Organization for Progress. In fact, for years now since our founding, we have been attempting to convince Chairman Ham to accept an important role on the steering committee of the coalition, because we think the kind of work that the People's Organization for Progress does is exemplary, and it is something that should be emulated throughout the country and throughout the world. It is an impressive formation, and thank you so much for your welcome. And I feel like it's really important for us to recognize your significance, not only in this city, but as a model for what democratic struggle and resistance should and could look like throughout this country. So, Uhuru. This, the presentation that I am about to make has been mischaracterized as a political report. This is because the coalition, since our inception, as Comrade Secretary Aisha has indicated, has been an extremely busy coalition. In fact, we've been so busy that our activities have really overwhelmed much of what we needed to do organizationally to consolidate ourselves as an organization. We've had three incredibly significant conferences: the founding conference in St. Petersburg, Florida, in February 2010, the magnificent conference, National Conference Against the Other Wars, that was held in Washington, D.C., that actually functioned as a criticism of the traditional anti-war or peace movement, in the sense that that movement does not traditionally or generally criticize imperialism. Rather, what it generally does is criticize some policy or another of imperialism as is reflected in foreign policy adventures, wars, etc. We feel, and the other thing that's problematic is with the general anti-war or peace movement is that it allows the ruling class to establish the terms of what is war and what is peace. And so that we recognize that George Bush wanted peace, he just wanted the oppressed people to stop fighting back, which would have resulted in peace. We say that it's not good enough to call for peace, that one must take sides, and that it is our responsibility to not only call for peace, but call for victory of the oppressed peoples, victory for the people who are being assaulted. And so we also felt like it's really important to, with that conference that we had in Washington, D.C., to recognize, yes, it is righteous for peace, people who are talking about peace and against war, to lay their bodies down in front of tanks that are going to be deployed in an aggression against some people overseas. But we could see somebody laying down in front of police precincts right here in Newark and other places where African people have to contend with the military occupation of police organizations as well. We feel like a real peace movement has to recognize this war. A real peace movement has to recognize that we live in a country with concentration camps, have been since its inception, that are euphemistically referred to as reservations, where so many so-called Indians are kept in deplorable states of existence with a lifespan that does not go beyond the 40s in general. That a peace movement that is honest and truthful would have to recognize what is happening on these borders, where half of Mexico was stolen at gunpoint, and now the people who are crossing that illegitimate border that was created by the U.S. are characterized as illegals, and all kinds of military forces have been created just to deal with them. Where is the peace, that movement that cannot address that question we ask in our conference in Washington, D.C.? And what about Haiti, brothers and sisters? And what about what is happening in Africa? Why is it that we have a situation where since 1998, maybe 7 million African people have been killed in proxy wars that have been initiated, funded by the United States and other imperialist powers, and it doesn't hit the agenda of the peace movement or the anti-war movement? So we feel like it's absolutely, we felt like it was, this was a critical conference that we had to raise the question of the other wars, not just the wars that's recognized by the ruling class, but the wars that are impacting on the lives of black people, brown people, yellow people, red people here and around the world. And we felt like that was really important for our coalition to do. And of course, this is our third coalition. I just want to say, before getting into the presentation, that the coalition, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, is a coalition, it is an organization of organizations. It is, the objective was to really, among other things, consolidate some kind of unity between the anti-imperialist sector of the black movement. We hear all the time about the inability of ourselves to organize or to unite. We hear all the time about the fact that we have events just for the sake of events, but what happens after the event, we ask ourselves. And so we felt like pulling together a coalition that doesn't cost anybody anything, doesn't cost any organization its own identity, doesn't challenge the agenda of any organization. All it requires is unity with the basic principles that have been established and most of us have participated in. For example, the People's Organization for Progress was in the very first mobilization of the Black is Back Coalition. And there were other forces. People came in because of religious reasons. Some people came because Islam influenced their determination for justice. Some came as Christians because that's what influenced their determination. Others came as communists, as social democrats, as revolutionaries and democrats with the big D and the small D. But the thing is, the assumption was that we can pull together some kind of unity around a basic set of principles, and in this process establish an agenda, that a general and broad agenda that would allow us to make an anti-imperialist struggle. We said that it should not be necessary for any organization to try to carry out its mission on a local level anymore. If we exist in all these different places and we can create a single organization, that would mean that the People's Organization for Progress agenda in New Jersey would also be the Black is Back Coalition's agenda in St. Petersburg, Florida, or in London, England. We are much better off as a consequence of doing that. More than that, the principles of unity of the coalition states clearly that it does not challenge the ideological basis of any organization that comes into it. So that every decision is determined by an election, and every organization coming into the coalition has equal rights with every other organization. So that's the kind of organization that we have. Members, individuals who don't belong to organization, we believe you ought to be an organization, but we don't just believe that in some kind of general abstract way. So we say that individuals can join the coalition. You pay your dues, because the organization has to have the ability to carry out its mission. You can join as individuals, but we want to put you in one of these working groups, so that is how the individuals can participate in the organization through working groups. And at the end of the day, it's going to be the steering committee that will vote on all of the policy determinations that we have, as opposed to individuals, because we are a coalition of organizations. We are an organization of organizations. So I just wanted to make that statement. What I'm going to do is make a presentation that I am hoping the steering committee will adopt as the view or the position of the coalition on electoral politics for the coalition. This is not a substitute for the view of the African People's Socialist Party or the People's Organization Progress or any other organization. It is the coalition's view, just as the general principles belong to the coalition. But when any organization that's a member of the coalition, outside the coalition, is free, obviously, to act independently and even to raise up issues around what the coalition is doing based on the interpretation of that particular organization in the coalition. And when we speak for the coalition, then, of course, we have to adhere to principles and policies that we have collectively determined, which is why I want to make this presentation now and ask the steering committee to adopt this as the view of the coalition around the question of elections. So I just want to make that, and then at the end of this presentation, I'm going to call for a motion to adopt this, and then with that motion being second, we'll call for discussion that will function as the question and answer discussion period, but the actual vote will be done by the steering committee at a steering committee meeting. That is what the real agenda for tomorrow is a meeting of the steering committee that is open to everybody, but that's where determination will be made in terms of whether this is adopted as the view of the coalition. I hope I was clear. Uhuru. So, brothers and sisters and comrades, again, I really would like to express the appreciation of the Black is Black Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparation for your participation, and I would like to really express appreciation for people who got here on time, because I know how it works when you talk about an all-day coalition, all-day conference, all-day meeting. Because when you say it's all day, people take all day to get there. You understand? So I really appreciate the fact that folk got here on time, but we have to pursue this agenda, and we can't tarry to wait till more people come before we start, because we're renting this space, and the coalition doesn't have any money, as you will learn from the financial report that's going to be made at this meeting. On September 12, 2009, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations was organized in the wake of the campaign and election of Barack Hussein Obama as President of the United States. On today, 3 years later, this important international Black is Back conference is also contextualized by the upcoming U.S. presidential election featuring Barack Hussein Obama attempting to secure a second term at the helm of the most significant imperialist government to ever grace the face of the planet Earth. Nothing has happened within the last 3 years to challenge the rationale for founding the coalition. If anything, our views have been confirmed. There are many left liberals who voiced moderate disappointment with the performance of the first Black president, but most of us in the coalition, though sometimes reluctantly, were clear from the beginning that Obama's presidency did not represent a break with U.S. history of empire. This international conference on Obama, the elections, and the struggle for justice, peace, a better life, and black power provides an excellent opportunity to address the larger questions of elections in general and to specifically examine the role of elections in capitalist society. We will determine the possibilities, if any, as well as the limitations of the electoral process for advancing our struggle as oppressed Africans in the United States and throughout the world. There are a number of reasons this is important. For one thing, allowing the issue of elections to revolve around the candidacy and the presidency of Barack Hussein Obama is to invite a subjective response from everyone who supports Obama for whatever reasons. Secondly, the Black Liberation Movement has not dealt with the role of elections in our struggle as a movement since the heyday of the civil rights struggle and the brief but significant moment 40 years ago at the Black National Convention in Gary, Indiana in 1972. Is electoral politics a legitimate arena for struggle for genuine African anti-imperialists who are guided by principles of self-determination? And if so, what is it that confers legitimacy upon those who would enter into this arena? Is having a black face enough to win the support of Africans, and are there requirements that must be met by any candidate of any nationality to win the black vote? These are some of the questions that this conference must deal with. These are questions that are contextualized by the fact that a presidential election is rapidly approaching, and Obama is fighting for another term as U.S. president of the declining imperialist hegemon over a system obviously experiencing severe crisis. The evidence of this crisis intrudes into every aspect of our lives. The economic aspect of this crisis has recently crashed into the consciousness of many who have previously considered themselves disinterested in politics or apolitical. Now they are rushing to the barricades as Tea Partiers or occupiers in a frenzy because of the loss of their retirement funds or student loans. In many ways, these new entrants into the political arena are distorting the discussion, forcing into play agendas that fundamentally speak to the same white, imperialist, reliant interests as the past. While the political aspect of this imperialist crisis has been before us for some time now, especially in the form of unending wars, it has been up to the coalition to draw the attention to the connection between the political and economic aspects of this crisis, to show that the latter is born of the former, and that while it is the threat, and that it is the threat to the parasitic capitalist economy that makes perennial war inevitable. Zbigniew Brzezinski is a former national security advisor for U.S. President James Earl Carter and one of Obama's most influential advisors. In 2007, Brzezinski authored a book entitled Second Chance, Three Presidents and the Crisis of American Superpower, that was designed to help the U.S. ruling class recognize this crisis and to employ Brzezinski's solutions to deal with it. The sound is not that good, and I'm having to work too hard, you know, in terms of... Thank you. That sounds better already. Right there. Thank you very much. clearly not a revolutionary, Brzezinski offered this insight about the crisis that helps to make our point about the relationship between the political and economic crisis. And Brzezinski says, quote, "Global political awakening is historically anti-imperial, politically anti-Western, and emotionally clearly anti-American. In the process, it is setting in motion a major shift in the global center of gravity. That, in turn, is altering the global distribution of power, with major implications for America's role in the world. Imperial stability has historically depended on skilled domination, superior military organization, and ultimately, most important, political passivity on the part of dominated peoples. Anti-Westernism is thus more than a populist attitude. It is an integral part of the shifting global demographic, economic, and political balance," unquote. What Brzezinski is describing here is the unfolding resistance of the world's peoples to a parasitic arrangement that is the real basis of the economic crisis that has recently exposed itself to full view. It is this increasingly generalized global resistance to imperialism that threatens the student loans and the 401k retirement benefits that have mobilized a sizable section of the previously politically oblivious North American or white population. Some have concluded that this crisis of imperialism is the reason for the selection of Barack Hussein Obama by a sector of the U.S. white ruling class as their president of the United States. It was an attempt to give imperialism the face of the slave at a time when the slaves of the world were in a state of resistance that threatens the stability and existence of the imperialist system itself. We come to this conference fully aware that we have our own experiences with the electoral process to contribute to our understanding of its significance, its possibilities, and its limitations. The first of these experiences of importance for this discussion was the experience of Reconstruction lasting from 1865 to 1877. While most Africans in the U.S. are securely ensconced in the Democratic Party today, at the end of the U.S. Civil War and the former dissolution of colonial slavery, most Africans participated in the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln and emancipation. It was through the Republican Party of Lincoln during the Reconstruction era that Africans in the U.S. gained our initial experience with the U.S. electoral process that should contribute to our discussion of our participation in bourgeois elections. The tumultuous post-slavery Reconstruction era resulted in more than 1,500 Africans being elected to office throughout the southern United States. This is the same period that saw the birth of the Ku Klux Klan in 1866 and the concomitant rise of violence against African people in various locations in the South. Moreover, several southern states initially refused to comply with the Reconstruction Act and began a process of legal disenfranchisement through black codes and other means. Most who are familiar with the Reconstruction era know that in 1877, following a backroom deal between the Republican and Democratic parties, Republican Rutherford Hayes ascended to the U.S. presidency after a hotly contested election. In a deal known as the Tilden-Hayes Compromise, the Republican Hayes was allowed to take the presidency after promising to remove the remaining federal troops from the South that provided a modicum of protection for the newly enfranchised Africans. Most of us know that the removal of the remaining federal troops from the South resulted in an orgy of violence against our people that resulted in what came to be known in our history as the Great Exodus. It was a time when as many of us as possible fled the violence of the South, looking for new lands to settle in order to escape persecution, to find justice, peace, a better life, and black power over our own black lives. Less known, however, is the degree of violence and chicanery that prevailed throughout the entire Reconstruction period. The demobilization of federal or Union troops had actually begun almost immediately after the Civil War, where there were 1 million troops ostensibly protecting Africans in the South in May of 1865. By the end of that year, the number had shrunk to 150,000, and by October 1st, 1866, only 38,000 federal troops remained in the South. On July 30, 1866, several Africans were massacred in New Orleans. But unless we make the mistake of thinking this attack on the rights and lives of Africans was unusual, during the Reconstruction period, it must be noted that on September 1st, 1868, all the black elected officials were ousted from the Georgia legislature. And on September 28th of the same year, from 200 to 300 Africans were massacred in Opelousas, Louisiana. After the end of the Reconstruction period in 1877, it would be almost another 100 years of bloody repression and unspeakable crimes against our people until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 would bring a federal presence to the South again, ostensibly to protect the rights of Africans to vote. However, seeking a solution to the electoral process was not the overwhelming seeking a solution through the election process was not the overwhelming response of African to our situation in the post-Reconstruction era. We were learning from history, and it was becoming increasingly clear that we were suffering national oppression. We were beginning to understand that although many of us live in the U.S., we were suffering as an oppressed people, not only in the U.S., but everywhere we were located. It was this realization that informed the movement led by Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Associations and African Communities League. Some make the mistake of abstracting Garvey out of the general history of struggle within the era that he lived and organized. Some have neutralized his historical significance by declaring Garvey some kind of prophet or demagogue. These are people who do not connect the movement of Garvey with those of his contemporaries, such as Sun Yat-sen of China, Ho Chi Minh of Vietnam, Emiliano Zapata and Pancho Villa of Mexico, and Augusto Sandino of Nicaragua, among others. Seen by imperialist intelligence agents as the center of much of the world's resistance emanating from oppressed peoples, Garvey was persecuted, framed, tried, imprisoned, and deported from the U.S. as part of the overall attack contributing to his defeat and the organizational disintegration of the UNIA. It is worth noting that the millions of African followers of Garvey worldwide were not opposed to participating in the electoral process. However, the most important elections they participated in were those conducted by the UNIA itself. These were elections that revolved around the clearly identified interests of Africans. These interests manifested themselves in developing industries, the Black Star Shipping Line, factories, recording companies, the Black Cross nurses, and a host of other institutions of self-reliance and self-determination. These interests were also reflected at the International Convention of the UNIA held in 1920 at Madison Square Garden, where more than 25,000 Africans converged from throughout the world, and where Africans voted and voted and voted. They voted Garvey the Provisional President of Africa. They voted the red, black, and green as the flag of the independent African nation. They voted for a future that would free them from from a forcibly imposed relationship to the United States and other imperialist powers as oppressed subjects, dependence on the goodwill and institutions of the oppressor. The attack on the Garvey movement by all the imperialist powers clearly revealed what we will see over and over again. The imperialists do not respect any vote that does not further their aims of exploitation and world domination. Even while killing and harassing Africans out of the electoral process, we were severely punished when we attempted to opt out on our own and create independent institutions that addressed our own self-defined political reality. A primary focus of the civil rights movement within the U.S. was the struggle for the right to vote. This was based on the premise that the electoral process was the only legitimate method through which Africans could wage the struggle for rights and justice. It was a struggle that therefore bestowed a mantle of legitimacy over the very same oppressive system that was responsible for our status as oppressed people. Nevertheless, it was a struggle that would eventually go far beyond the limitations of its leadership that sought to fight for inclusion into the system without challenging the existence of the system. Sharecroppers and wage workers bravely stood up to the naked, proudly displayed brutality of the general white population of the South, as well as that of the U.S. government as it represented itself in that part of the country. After a decade of relentless struggle, of marches and demonstrations that were more often than not occasioned by assassinations, mass jailings and beatings, after assault by trained attack dogs, our homes and churches bombed, and our leaders and children murdered, the U.S. government was forced to pass legislation guaranteeing Africans the right to vote in 1965, with passage of the Voting Rights Act. However, by then, the struggle had gotten away from the leaders of the civil rights movement and their white liberal supporters. By then, the Mississippi Freedom Summer of 1964 had successfully exposed the hypocrisy of the U.S. electoral process and the Democratic Party to the world. Promised by an assortment of liberals that Africans from Mississippi who were denied the right to register and vote in Mississippi would be able to represent the Mississippi Democratic Party at the National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the U.S. president and great liberal statesman of the period, decided to seat the white Mississippi Democratic lynch mob party while offering the Africans who had risked life and limb to register and attend the National Convention 2 non-voting seats. When the heroic and now world-renowned Fannie Lou Hamer declared, "We didn't come all this way for no 2 seats when everybody is tired," and led the African Mississippi delegation out of the Democratic Party convention, she ushered in a new era of politics within the U.S. and a split between the African community and the liberal sector of U.S. imperialists. Betrayed by the Democratic Party of the day, just as we have been betrayed by the Republican and Democratic parties of the past, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a dynamic vanguard element of the civil rights movement, went into Lowndes County, Alabama to organize the Lowndes County Freedom Organization that was to be a black political party through which Africans in the county would struggle for political power. This was the real beginning of a struggle for independent black political power through the electoral process that should serve to inform our conference on today. The symbol chosen for the black political party was the now iconic Black Panther. And indeed, the ruling class media began to refer to the Lowndes County Freedom Organization as the Black Panther Party. This historical trajectory was fueled in 1966 by the mass demand for black power, heralding from SNCC leadership in Mississippi and gripping the imagination of Africans and others worldwide. This was going far beyond the demands of the civil rights leaders who were simply attempted to integrate into the capitalist system and who understood elections to be the appropriate vehicle for achieving that goal. Obviously, rather objectively, and independent of the will of its advocates, the demand for black power elevated the struggle of Africans in the United States from one for civil rights within the capitalist system to the same anti-colonial status on the continent of Africa and of the peoples of Vietnam, Palestine, the Middle East, and South America. Implicit in the struggle for black power was the assumption of anti-colonial struggle by a people for national liberation. This fact was punctuated in the same year of 1966 when urbanized Africans in Oakland took up the symbol, that's Oakland, California, took up the symbol and name of the Lowndes County Freedom Organization and organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense that would later be known as the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party was conscious of its connection with the revolutionary trajectory sweeping the earth and openly declared its relationship to the anti-imperialist movements and resistance of Vietnam, Africa, South America, and the rest of the world. With a slogan borrowed from the revolutionary Chinese Communist Party of the time, the Black Panther Party, although open to participation in electoral politics, boldly declared political power comes from the barrel of a gun. The struggle of Africans in the United States rendered the U.S. an ideological and political defeat within its own borders. The masses of Africans had turned our backs on the United States and were creating our own independent political institutions that were informed by our own aspirations and ideological assumptions. In all the essential ways, our struggle had returned to the basic premise of the Garvey movement that was also contained in the worldview of the Nation of Islam and most pronounced in the developing philosophy of Malcolm X. From the freedom schools of the Southern Civil Rights Movement to the free breakfast for school children and sickle cell anemia testing programs of the Black Panther Party and a myriad of other independent efforts, Africans were breaking free of the political and ideological influences of the U.S. capitalist system. A primary ideological influence of the time was the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X. The Nation of Islam helped to reintroduce the national question, the so-called national question, into our political life and preached independence with his do-for-self philosophy. Malcolm X introduced revolutionary theory, politics, and organization that will unite African people around the world with the revolutionary activities and aspirations of the masses of peoples fighting against colonialism everywhere. In the words of the then revolutionary Chinese Communist Party, there was great disorder under the heavens, and revolution was the main trend sweeping the world. The world was rejecting the imperialist order and all its imposed institutions and assumptions, including the electoral process as the only legitimate means through which an oppressed people had a right to win power over our lives. Indeed, the greater question was whether elections could deliver freedom for a people oppressed under the same system through which elections were effected. It was its loss of ideological and political authority and hegemony that resulted in the U.S. military assault on our independent anti-imperialist black power movement and the worldwide revolutionary project. The U.S. government began a wholesale campaign of murder, terror, and mass arrests that assassinated leaders, destroyed our organizations, and dispersed our members, some of whom were chased into permanent exile from the United States. Our independent revolutionary news organs were undermined and destroyed, and our communities beset by an inundation of drugs, first heroin, and later a deadly devastating derivative of cocaine. In 1969, the last symbolic nail was hammered into the coffin of our revolution with the assassination of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther Party leader in Chicago, Illinois. However, in March of 1972, Africans gathered in Gary, Indiana for the National Black Convention. Chairman Lawrence Ham was there. It was an incredible convocation of Africans from throughout the U.S. and the Caribbean, convened by Gary's mayor, Richard Hatcher, who had come to power in the wake of the extraordinary Black Power movement of the 60s. The Gary Declaration eloquently stated our cause. And here's a brief excerpt from that declaration. This is important. Quote, "For more than a century," it said, "we have followed the path of political dependence on white men and their systems." I suspect that this declaration was written from somebody else from Newark, but that's another story. He said, the declaration said, "For more than a century, we have followed the path of political dependence on white men and their systems. From the Liberty Party in the decades before the Civil War to the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln, we trusted in white men and white politics as our deliverers. 60 years ago, W.E.B. Du Bois said he would give the Democrats their last chance." That was 60 years prior to 1972. W.E. Du Bois said that he would give the Democrats their last chance to prove their sincere commitment to equality for black people. And he was given white riots and official segregation in peace and in war. Nevertheless, some 20 years later, we became Democrats in the name of Franklin Roosevelt, then supported his successor, Harry Truman, and even tried a so-called nonpartisan Republican general of the army named Eisenhower. We were wooed, like many others, by the superficial liberalism of John F. Kennedy and the make-believe populism of Lyndon Johnson. Let there be no more of that. Here at Gary, let us never forget that while the times and the names and the parties have continually changed, one truth has faced us insistently, never changing. Both parties have betrayed us whenever their interests conflicted with ours, which was most of the time, and whenever our forces were unorganized and dependent, quiescent, and compliant. Nor should this be surprising, for by now we must know that the American political system, like all other white institutions of America, was designed to operate for the benefit of the white race. It was never meant to do anything else. If we have never faced it before, let us face it at Gary. The profound crisis of black people and the disaster of America are not simply caused by men, nor will they be solved by men alone. These crises are the crises of basically flawed economics and politics and or cultural degradation. None of the Democratic candidates and none of the Republican candidates, regardless of their vague promises to us or to their white constituencies, can solve our problems or the problems of this country without radically changing the systems by which it operates. Unquote. Although there were to be a number of Africans elected to political office subsequent to the Gary Convention, the reality is that its significance was severely undermined by the military defeat of our revolution of the 60s. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were dead. So were Fred Hampton and more than 30 members of the Black Panther Party. Mass arrests of African patriots in the United States had been successfully implemented under the infamous COINTEL program of the FBI. More than 300 of them Black Panther Party members in 1968 alone. Patrice Lumumba had been assassinated by U.S., Belgium, and French agents in Congo, and Kwame Nkrumah had been overthrown by the U.S. in Ghana. In Bolivia, Che Guevara, wounded and captured by the CIA, by CIA operatives, was brutally murdered. The Gary Convention offered a magnificent demonstration of the aspirations of our people for independent, radical political participation in the U.S. political arena, but it was a convention that, extraordinary as it was, had already been made impotent by the destruction of the revolutionary organizations and social movement that energized it and in whose wake it occurred. This is not to say that the position of this coalition should be that the electoral process is not something that we should utilize in our quest for peace, justice, a better life, and black power. Rather, it is to say that history teaches us that our struggle cannot be reliant on the electoral process. It teaches us that in every instance that we relied on the electoral process, we were not only betrayed, but we had no independent, strategically informed capacity to identify and fight for our own interests as an oppressed and colonized people. Our history should also inform us that there is nothing natural or inevitable about our participation in the electoral process. It's not in the Bible. The truth is that we were jailed, assassinated, and gunned back into the political process after we had clearly elevated our struggle to another higher self-serving level. This gives lie to the notion that somehow the election of Barack Hussein Obama represents progress in our struggle for freedom. The reality is that our reliance on Obama and the Democratic Party represents a serious setback that we must overcome if we are to ever be really free as a people. The election of Obama was made possible in part because the murder and imprisonment of our revolutionary leaders and the destruction of our own independent revolutionary organizations and the dispersal of their members made it unnecessary for the Democratic Party through Obama to address a single issue that is important to African people or any other oppressed people in the United States and the world. Indeed, Obama's black face, his black self, became the only imperialist program offered to African people. Nevertheless, it would be a mistake at this point in our struggle to dismiss the use of the electoral process altogether. The fact is that the electoral process does offer us the democratic space to educate the masses of our people, who for the most part participate in political life primarily through the ruling class organized elections and political parties. We must never voluntarily accede this democratic space to our oppressors. One exception to this rule would be when the system has fallen in such disfavor among the masses and the crisis of imperialism has become so pervasive that our participation would serve primarily to validate a system that otherwise cannot claim legitimacy. Generally speaking, we are also open to some use of the electoral process because this is the method by which neo-colonialists, and others who claim to represent our interests win authenticity from within and without our community. We cannot allow hostile politics and ideologies to monopolize this important political space without a fierce fight back. We must take the resistance up into the electoral process itself. We must take the resistance up into the electoral process itself to fight against imperialist ideologies and programs, to fight against neo-colonialism within the electoral process itself, a process that is generally recognized by the masses as legitimate, gives legitimacy to our revolutionary anti-colonial, anti-imperialist politic, and over a period of time can educate the masses of our people while exposing imperialism and forcing it to move openly in ways that will bring discredit to the system among our people. However, this must not be seen as an individual endeavor, as most electoral politics are. We must be truly representative of our people, and the agenda that we represent must be one that is crafted from our relationship with the people, whose popular participation is central to its creation. Moreover, we must not promote the electoral process as the only or even the primary way for the people to achieve power. We cannot say that if the colonial system were not accede to black power by the electoral process, we do not have any other options. We can't say that. In fact, we must create the options, destroying the proverbial claptrap from some leftists and so-called revolutionaries that ask, if not Obama and the Democrats, then what? When we witness how Africans were treated during and after Reconstruction in the U.S., and how the U.S. and other so-called democracies overthrew and murdered the duly elected Patrice Lumumba of Congo, and overthrew the elected governments of Guatemala and Iran in the 1950s, or most recently of Hugo Chavez of Venezuela in 2002, and of Manuel Zelaya of Honduras in 2009, it is clear that the imperialist ruling class respects the electoral process only when it serves their needs. The fact is that elections within the capitalist colonial system only serve as nonviolent contests, nonviolent struggles between different sectors of the ruling class for control of the state, which is the primary organ of coercion through which the capitalists pursue their political and economic interests. Elections offer a form of systemic stability. All the vested, privileged beneficiaries of the system, especially its ruling class, need this nonviolent process to serve and be recognized as the only legitimate means through which political power is to be sought. Ultimately, although different individuals will win and lose, and different sectors of the ruling class and other privileged social forces may win or lose, as long as the struggle is confined to the electoral process, the system of exploitation and oppression is generally safe. In fact, Africans have at times been encouraged to join ruling class parties and to run for political office, functioning as pipers to draw African political activity into the safe embrace of a democratic party and the imperialist system during times of crisis when African people might look otherwise outside the system for solutions. Our task is not to contribute to the stabilization of a system of global oppression and exploitation. It is not our task to rescue imperialism from the crisis that has its reeling desperately from one crime to another in attempts to stanch the wounds stemming from the people's resistance. Yes, let us use the electoral process right now as one form of struggle, but let us at the same time recognize that it is only one form of struggle, and that our future depends on our willingness to build a real capacity to utilize every form of struggle in the quest for our liberation, to concentrate our political efforts within the electoral system without building genuine, independent revolutionary organization is to invite the disaster of the past and leave our future and our people at the mercy of the vicious white nationalist system that has enslaved, colonized, and betrayed us time after time. Malcolm X once said, "We should win our freedom by any means necessary." This statement was too ambiguous about our possibilities within the U.S.-led imperialist system. Today, we must affirmatively declare that we will use all necessary means to wrench our freedom and future out of the grasp of a dying imperialist system that by its very nature is incapable of conferring freedom on Africans or any other oppressed people on this earth. Uhuru. So, brothers and sisters, as I mentioned earlier on, what I would do is, where am I rich? Did I Where am I in terms of the time? Okay. And what I would like to do is call for motion for the Black is Back Coalition to adopt this as our position around elections. And then if I can get this motion seconded, I will call for discussion. And then we will shut off the discussion within the time frame allotted for us. And then the vote by the steering committee will happen at the steering committee meeting, which will be tomorrow. And everybody is invited to participate, to be there for that steering committee meeting. But this allows everybody an opportunity to have a discussion around the question. So can I get a motion for adoption of this as the...
So moved.
It's been moved. Can I get a second? Moved and second. Then I would like to open it up for discussion. The floor is yours, Uhuru. Yes, my friend. Is there another mic? It's great to see these yellow T-shirts in the office. Yeah. Black and yellow does do go together. Uhuru.
I appreciate your whole presentation. There's nothing in there that I disagree with. I agree with all of it. And I too, you know, take the same view that the electoral process is just one of many tools that we'll have to use. As Malcolm said, by any means necessary. He said we've been betrayed by this system on, you know, time after time by both parties. So going independent is our only way. But I appreciate your presentation. It was historically no one can argue with.
Thank you, sir.
But that word of Uhuru always bring, I'm an old school, always bring back to memory of me what took place, of course, among the Mau Mau in Kenya.
Yes.
That's where that term became popular.
That's right. Thank you so much. Uhuru. People can indicate whether or not there is behind you. There's also, okay. Kefing, there's somebody behind you too.
Uhuru, Chairman. Yeah, I just want to express unity with the paper and the position of the coalition. I look forward to the vote tomorrow. I think this is a brilliant analysis of what elections, what they can potentially mean for the African community. And I just want to salute the Black is Back Coalition and you, Chairman, for your leadership of the Black is Back Coalition for around this portion of elections.
Uhuru. My name is Kenneth Washington from the state. I'd like to ask you two questions, basically, because you said so many things I'm historically familiar with. If the Israel bombed Iraq, should black Americans participate in it when the president said he's not the president of Afro-America?
I'm glad that you even introduced that, because it's an extremely serious period that we're in now. The U.S. Most of you know that there's this war talk being directed at Iran. It is coming from Israel and the United States. Israel, of course, is a military outpost of U.S. imperialist power, and not only is this happening, but there's literally war that's already existing between them. The U.S. and the state of Israel have utilized Stuxnet, which is an invasion into the internet, what do you call it, computer system that really disrupted their program, nuclear development program. They have assassinated scientists. in various places of the world, Iranian scientists. They have bombed installations inside Iran. This has been going on for a while now. And neither of them, they haven't made a public pronouncement, because to do so would create an inevitable, you know, like military confrontation that I don't think either of them is prepared to have right now. I'll also mention in the paper that the United States government overthrew the elected Mohammed Mossadegh, 1955, overthrew the government and placed this guy who came, you know, with the Shah of Iran in power, who was a brutal, vicious, murderer, dictator there. So that even when Iranians in this country were trying to protest against what was happening there, they actually had to wear, and there were mostly students, sacks over their heads, so that the Savak, the intelligence organization from the Iranians, could not identify them and murder their families at home. And then this government was the government that was overthrown by the present government in power in Iran today, in 1979. So everything that all the stance and politic of the Iranian is justified by the history of the relationship they've had with the United States and the West. You know why one of the main reasons that they overthrew Mossadegh? BP, British Petroleum, the same oil that just caused this great contamination in the Gulf, the Iranians were nationalizing their own oil. So Africans would be foolhardy to participate in any kind of aggression against that people. To paraphrase, you know, Muhammad Ali, ain't no Iranians call us niggas and shooting down our children in the streets of America, you know, with wearing police uniforms. Doesn't make any sense at all.
The last question I want to ask. Since he said he's not the president of Afro-Americans, should we vote for the next election? No. See, you don't realize. I know what he said. See, you just live this life. When he simply said us, he ain't said nobody else.
Right.
He ain't through to no other people but us. When he said Afro-Americans, we can relate to us.
Yeah.
We relate to all the black people coming, didn't come, and I ain't not black and all that foolishness. So when that question is asked, that's a serious question.
It is.
Because we will lose our lives for that foolishness, and y'all don't even know it.
It is a very serious question, and I think that what's really important for us, you have to make up your mind, those of you who are participating in this electoral process. The Black is Back Coalition has been pretty clear about Obama since its inception. We held the first national demonstration against the Obama at the White People's House in November 7th, 2009. This brother here, stand up, brother. Stand up. You, yeah. Y'all recognize this brother? When in St. Petersburg, Florida, when September, I think it was, 2008, when Obama came to St. Petersburg, Florida, and the first time you ever heard Obama stutter was when this brother said, "What about the black community?" And that's when Obama started stuttering. And of course, it was in Harlem, New York, at the first so-called presidential candidates debate that Obama asked the question in Harlem, of all places, and came out in opposition to reparations, declaring that it would be wrong to pay so much attention to those who have been historically wronged, meaning us, then crawled down to Miami to deal with a Jewish population who claimed that they've been wronged historically, and gave them Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem, you understand, which no other so-called president has ever done before. This is Barack Hussein Obama. And then the only statements he's ever made about Africans have been negative. Attacked black fathers, went to Africa, stood up in Ghana, where Kwame Nkrumah initiated a movement to unite black people all around the world and declared that the problems You cannot say the problems of Africa have anything to do with the white man or colonialism, that African leaders are the responsibility. This is the Obama. You make your decision. He's not made one statement of support to what should be his natural constituency, but to every other constituency. This is the basis of even the question of same-sex marriages he supports. And this is not an anti-statement. This is not a statement against that. Please don't hear me. But I'm saying that he can speak to any constituency. You know, Ron, you know he's so-called Hispanics, even though he's thrown more people, more Mexicans out of the country than Bush did, twice as many. But he can at least pretend to stand up for so-called Hispanics, as he characterized them. You know, so it's only us that he cannot seem to have a relationship to, and that's because we are the poison pill that America has never been able to swallow. And that makes the point. That makes the point that you know, we're talking about in terms of being out of our minds to rely solely on the electoral process as a means through which we seek our freedom in this country. Uh-huh.
I really, really want to appreciate this paper. And I think this discussion is such a timely one. It has to happen right now. The bourgeoisie is running a campaign on CNN. Vote as if your life depended on it. And that's the way that they expect for our people to, you know, have this.
And it's the Negro who's doing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
As if your life depended. And I think this is a cold, sober analysis. You know, to say, wait a minute, we can't have knee-jerk reactions. We can't have reactions because we feel warm and fuzzy about somebody because he's one of us or he belongs to us. We have to look at this question of our lives and look at this question of where we are today politically in terms of this system and the great opportunities that it provides us right now. And I think this is such a timely discussion because it's about time that we analyze this electoral process and how we should, you know, participate in it and when we should participate in it. So I really, you know, really, really appreciate this analysis. It's an analysis based on what is out there in the real world. And in order for us to win our freedom, we have to be able to really look at things for what they are and what, you know, not what's in our head, but what's out in the real world. And what we see in the real world is that we have to use any means necessary to get our, you know, our freedom. And the electoral process is only one means.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we should do that when it serves us. When we bring our agenda to the agenda and say, how do you respond to our agenda?
Right.
That's it. And I think this is really great. I wanted to ask you about even the situation in South Africa, you know, Azania, so-called South Africa, where this government has been voted in and the massacre that just, you know, happened with our people. I just think that, again, one of the clearest examples.
It makes the point for us, too, because in South Africa, you didn't really overturn the system. You just had put black faces administering the same damn system that was there all along and the same economic interests that were there all along. This is the point that we're making, that what, and I'm not saying that people should not have participated in the electoral process in South Africa. I think I was a part of the international discussion that was happening in the organization I was associated with that was happening around this negotiated peace, because from its history, the African National Congress, and yes, that old Negro Nelson Mandela that you love so much, from its history, its whole strategy has been armed negotiations. It has never fought to take the power. In fact, the ANC, as a matter of policy, would refuse to kill a white person. It was what they call it, about soft targets. They were opposed to soft targets, just blowing up symbols and stuff like that to create a crisis that would allow them to force negotiations. So we got a negotiated situation in South Africa. And not only do we have a negotiated situation, we have a setup, just like you have here. Just like we just had in Brooklyn, New York, where the black guys wanted to be to win that congressional election that Charles Barron ran in. The black guy that they wanted to win is the one that they pushed in. Just like they did with Cynthia McKinney, they did the same thing in South Africa. Clinton's own campaign advisors and what have you went and worked with the African National Congress to put them in power, and they sent truckloads of money to make sure that the ANC went to power. And what we're looking at is a continuation of the same system that was there. It's just got a black face to it. And that's really important, because most of us are not aware of what the hell is going on and understanding that the fundamental question is the nature of the social system itself. For us or anybody, if for Chairman Ham to be elected as President of the United States and presiding over that same institution, you won't get a damn different outcome. The thing is, the system creates the organization and structures that perpetuates it. So unless he went in there with a wrench to disrupt it, unless we had masses of people that was designed to disrupt and overturn the system itself, it's going to create the same thing. You're going to get the same outcome. Anyway, that's another story. Uhuru.
Uhuru. Uhuru. In the interest of time, I know that we need to move on. But I just wanted to briefly say a couple of things. The presentation given, I support it completely. And I wanted to...
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, I'm Deacon Kenfin Mikael from St. Michael's Ethiopian Orthodox Church.
Right.
Came here to network in this event. And just two brief, very brief things. One, I wanted to recognize and make everyone aware of the death of a very prominent spiritual man, Abuna Paulos, the patriarch of Ethiopia, unfortunately lost his life at the age of 76 this past Thursday. Just want to make everyone aware of that, and to please keep him in your prayers. And also, just a question about the situation of the OAU. New female was, I believe from South Africa, was chosen, Zuma, chosen to head that. I was wondering, is there any, in your opinion, analyzing the situation, is her chairmanship of the OAU going to be a potentially a good situation for our people internationally, or could it be problematic?
I don't even think it's problematic. I think that's an understatement. I think the AU is the OAU without the O, effectively. Africa is troubled. You've got the United States government that has instituted this militarization of the entire continent of Africa in the form of a program that's recognized called AFRICOM, which is an Africa Command System Center. That has the whole Africa, or all of Africa, as its, for lack of a better term, battleground. That's AFRICOM. First, really official act was the lynching of Libyan President Gaddafi, and it is now engaged in all kinds of mischief and war. In Somalia, it has mobilized Kenyan troops in Somalia after Ethiopian troops were there first. It is wreaking havoc all over the continent of Africa, and not a single word has come from the AU about that. Not one word, not a single word has come from the AU about the fact that we're still trying to exist within these artificially created borders that the imperialists created, which denies Africa even the ability to have a continental-wide economy. If you can't have a continental-wide economy, that means you got 54 distinct so-called countries, and they ain't even that, right? That's trying to negotiate with these imperialist powers. You got a situation with China, with 10% perhaps of the natural resources of Africa growing rapidly in terms of economic development, on the one hand, but in Africa, impoverished, the richest landmass on the planet Earth, bar none, but impoverished. And one reason is because when England deals with China, it deals with one China. When France deals with China, it deals with one China. European Union, one China. But when they deal with Africa, they deal with 54 different Africans, which means that there is no coherent policy of any kind, economic policy, foreign policy, anything at all. And that Africa will never advance until that problem is dealt with. And even for all of this talk about it, about parliaments, you know, pan-African parliaments, and nobody is really criticizing those borders and the fact they got to come down. The only one who recently did it is now, has was lynched on public view. People saw that lynching in terms of Gaddafi. So I don't think it makes any difference. And Zuma was a former wife of the Zuma, who is now the president in South Africa, And the president of South Africa is even apologizing for the police that just gunned down 34 or more African workers who were simply striking and demanding better wages at a mine in South Africa that produces the majority of the platinum, the world's platinum. That platinum is not going to African people in Africa. That platinum, you're going to find that, you know, in America and all these other, you know, situations. So, no, I don't think it's going to make a difference. What's going to make a difference is a genuine revolutionary movement, and that's what we have to be committed to. I'm convinced of that, that Nkrumah was right, Lumumba was right, and our revolutionary leaders of the past have been right. We've just been pushed into this relatively dormant stage again, where elections either within these countries or around the world have been offered to us as the only solutions, and they keep us working, it seems to me, within the same structural frameworks that were created by our oppression in the first place. Ooh, we have to move. Okay, yes, sister. Yeah, I'm well. Thank you so much.
My name is Miriam Bay, and I live here in New York, and I want to welcome you for coming here.
Thank you so much.
And thank you as well. And I also want to thank you for the fact that you continue to give us a history of what's going on. And it really has, nothing has really changed that much, in my opinion. You know, when we talk about the politics of President Obama and his election, it was historical in one point, but on the other point, it hasn't done us any great good as far as Black Americans. Now, my reason for coming here today was when I saw the Black Is Back Coalition, I just assumed that it was going to be a conference on Black folks coming together to talk about the issues that we're going to as a people. You talk about politics internationally, but as we know, all politics is local. So we're having some serious issues with our local politics. And we're having serious, serious issues with housing, with gun violence, with gang violence. And while everything that you said is important, and I support everything that you said internationally, because everything is relevant, but what is relevant to us right now is, like, locally, what do you think that we can all do, not just here in Newark, but all over, because in all of our urban communities, they're taking over our school systems. I mean, it's just like horrendous what's going on with us right now. So what would be the one thing that you would suggest that we could do to hold our local officials accountable and President Obama if he is reelected? Because is there a big difference between Obama and Romney? You know, because it's all part of the system. You know, so what is the first thing that you think that we should do?
I read from one ruling class journal, they refer to him as Barack O'Romney, saying that there really isn't any difference. I mean, if you listen to the debates that's going on, the stuff they're fighting about, you said something about my mama, I didn't say that kind of stuff, there's none of the critical questions that's impacting on the lives of people here and around the world are even being debated or discussed in any meaningful way. They aren't talking about those questions. And it's even worse than that. But here's what I believe that we have to do. The first place is that we have a lot of local organizations trying to take on the same kind of issues that you're talking about. But we're doing this in isolation from each other. You're going to hear before this conference is over, if you stay here long enough, a report from the Black Is Back branch that was just created in Oakland, California. They came out of a conference where they did a litany of the same kinds of problems that you just mentioned happening there in Oakland. But that's in Oakland. And the thing is that makes it significant is that I'm going to ask this coalition to adopt the resolutions coming from the Oakland branch of the Black Is Back Coalition, local coalition, as the resolutions for the entire organization. So that now it's no longer just an Oakland situation, but also it's something that, you know, that that we all become conscious of. And we are now, like, in the process of trying to build a real international response to the local situation. So that what now, you know, is happening, you know, like, there's an issue coming out of Germany where an African was murdered there in the police station. They had him chained to a mattress and then torched him so that, you know, charcoal, his body was charcoal. But nobody, you don't know anything about it. You don't know anything about Uri Jalloh and et cetera, et cetera. That needs to become a part of our agenda here. What's happening to our brothers and sisters there? The only point that I'm making is that the Black is Black Coalition will never be a substitute for any local organization. We don't try to treat ourselves as a substitute for this local organization, that local organization. What it tries to do is offer all our organizations an opportunity to internationalize the situation that we are dealing with here so that we don't have to deal with them individually. So what I'm hoping is that one of the things that will come out of this conference, and it is a Black is Black Coalition conference, is the development, the emergence of a real Black is Black Coalition, local Black is Black Coalition organization. Like I said earlier in my presentation, and like Brother Larry Adams also said, I mean, you have this incredible history of resistance and struggle in Newark. And right now, you've got what I believe is one of the most outstanding organizations engaged in practical, real resistance in the country, right here in Newark, in the form of People's Organization for Progress. But here is my problem. The problem is that what's happening in Newark should be generalized throughout this country. It shouldn't just be happening in Newark. It should be happening everywhere. And part of my call for the People's Organization Progress is to take a prominent role in the Black is Black Coalition so that we can generalize that. Because what you bring, I've been to your meetings here. And they have been incredible, democratic, fiercely fought, sometimes struggles that should be, that I think are exemplary and something that we should be doing everywhere. So my point is that we are engaged in a struggle right now. And our leaders have double-crossed us, betrayed us. I'm talking about Negroes, not just Obama, but virtually every Negro nutter. What's this guy's name here? What's his name? Booker, all up and down the board. We got more Black elected officials in this country right now, maybe 8,000-10,000 of them, and twice as many Negroes who have been appointed to office, but the actual conditions of our people are worse now than they were at the end of the Civil Rights, at the Civil Rights Movement. And these Negroes have done it, but they get a free pass. And this is the criticism we get. How do they get a free pass? Because they killed Malcolm, they killed Martin, they killed Fred Hampton, they killed and destroyed our organizations. And then the earth is littered with the bodies of dead people who tried to fight for us. And then what we get is these cretins, who are left behind, right? And they get a free pass from us just because they're Black. So we can't criticize them. We can't say anything about them. So Obama is worse than Bush in every way. Obama is worse than Bush. More war, more dead people, more assassinations, more immigrants, so-called immigrants, people kicked out of the country, more Black people being shot down in the streets around this country. And not only that, more silence in the face of it than Bush ever could have got away with. He's got a free ride because he's got a left-handed jump shot and a pimp limp, right? He don't have to say nothing to us. All you got to do is show some news clips of him playing basketball and his pimp limp. White people don't know nothing about the pimp limp, see, but we do. And that's the way we say he's just winking at us. Yeah, he's winking all right. So I'm saying this. This is what I'm saying. I'm talking about Al Sharpton. I'm talking about Jesse Jackal. I'm talking about all of those who have not stood up and confronted this system the way we need to confront it, who set the kinds of examples for our children in these streets who don't know who to shoot now because they got some Negro saying, after all is done, said and done, all you got to do is get on your knees and pray. Or vote for Obama, or vote for this person or that person. I'm saying that we have to be a real movement now. That's what I'm hoping the Black is Black Coalition can contribute to. That's why I want what POP is doing here to be happening all around the damn country. They said, don't tell me that Obama is a continuation of King. of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King declared that America is the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. So we have to build organizations, sister. And I agree with you that local politics we have to confront on every level, but part of that confrontation is going to have to be exposing and removing these Negroes who are pretending to represent us. Because as long as they can hold a press conference and say they represent us and nobody's contending with them, then it seems to be, to the world, it seems to be the truth. I've talked too long. Yes, yes. Uhuru, brother. Uhuru, yeah. Power to the people.
And you keep on speaking truth to power. Like Brother Amenifu, particularly as the maker of the motion formally, I felt compelled to stand to rise and speak in favor of it. The historical analysis is precise and clear. The details, the class struggle, particularly in the area of elections and what role that has played in advancing organization and disempowering our people when it becomes a monopoly form of political expression. That lesson, that fundamental political lesson, is absolutely, I feel, true and necessary. It's going to be a hard sell. Because the task before us, particularly given the Oppressed Afro-American people, how hard it has been to fight for the right to vote. Not the right to vote for Obama, but the right to vote for political expression has been so near and dear, and in fact has represented mass mobilization and struggle, which is the important task, the capacity to mobilize the masses for political expression. Means that we have to be very tactical in how we handle the spread of the message. That electoral politics cannot be our only form of political expression, and in fact should not be the main one that we rely upon. I would give the example in the workplace where unions and workers formerly literally fought for bosses, and the measure was the axe handle. Well, what got substituted is grievance and arbitration procedures. What happens is that the masses of workers are disempowered. They're separated from their own unions. They don't know about what the issues are. Just 2 years later, somebody gets a result on a grievance, and the struggle of the people is disorganized. Well, monopoly elections does the same thing for the mass struggle. If elections are the monopoly of political expression, so we have to fight against it. I would hope, but we have to, in our speaking of truth to power, have to be tactically wise about how we not isolate ourselves from the masses of people, because they, in fact, who make history. Not we, the activists, not those of us who would strive to lead. So we have to be tactical and balanced, but we got to speak truth. If we only rely on elections, it's within the enemy's ballpark and their rules. Without a mass movement that goes beyond the limitations that are provided, it's a lost activity. Specifically, I would hope that we would come out of this conference supporting the demonstrations and opposition is going to be at the Democratic National Convention, DNC, in Charlotte in next month. And that when we take up this question, the tactic of elections, we're going to emphasize that it's the program, not the person, that's the most important. Uhuru
Sasa. Thank you. I want to appreciate the observation that was made by this brother. And I want to say that people learn through struggle. And that one weakness that we've had is, unlike here in Newark, where we've got an organization like People's Organization of Progress, people learn through struggle. Fannie Lou Hamer was a damn sharecropper who was not expected to have any impact on history at all. She was being used by certain sectors of the African population when she was brought into political life. Her objective was to open the door for the black middle class to be able to be elected and be all these other things. But because, and that was generally true for most of us, we were somebody else's, we were objects of somebody else's plan. But the thing is that once people are in struggle, trying to change the world, the people become changed themselves. And that is the fundamental power. The power is in the people engaged in struggle and our ability to engage the people in efforts to change their circumstances. I heard what you said about being tactful, etc. But when we look at the issue of tactics and strategy, what we also have to be really clear about is that the strategic objectives are always buried, wedded to, connected to our tactics. Otherwise, what appears to be a short-term goal is actually our long-term goal. Because if, you know, that's what every Negro tell us. That's what they tell us about Obama. They say, well, you know, he's just there now, and we can't get the whole thing. We just have to take what we got now, because that's all that's possible. If he said this and that, he couldn't be elected. Nonsense. And Obama couldn't have got elected if he had said certain things. But I say that Obama would have been more valuable to our people and to the people of the world if he had stood up and took a Reverend Wright stance. If he had stood up and stood up for the people, he would have been more valuable in terms of what he would have contributed to us in terms of alerting the masses to be organized and to struggle against this system than to be elected and to be sitting up there talking about black daddies. You know, we are suffering from a destruction of a revolutionary movement. We must remember that. And since that time, what has become tactical has been that which we have been informed of by the people who now don't intend to raise any kind of struggle. We have to use this space to help to bring the people to a higher level of struggle. Higher level. And I can go back historically. And because there were times in our movement we wouldn't be faced with the question, if not Obama, who? And I'm saying that our weakness is organization, that we have to be organized, and we have to be organized independently of the institutions controlled by the ruling class. We have to be organized independently of the institutions controlled by the ruling class. And then we set the terms for our relationship with them. That's what everybody else does. When Obama goes to Miami, he goes on his belly, crawling like a snake. You understand? Because they have said, this is the agenda, boy. What do you think? You know, this is that you have to be. We have to create our own agenda, and our people can be won to it. Our people can be won to dealing with these conditions in our community. We don't. The starting point doesn't have to be Obama. It can be the police killing our people. It can be the fact that Obama's financial secretary, when his first campaign, Penny Pritzker, created the so-called subprime mortgage. She's the one who created it. How the hell can Obama get rid of it? She was going to be his trash. She was going to be, he wanted her to be over the Treasury Department, but her record was so nasty that it would have been impossible. She had to decline. So this is who we're looking at when we're looking at Obama. We're looking at the Chicago politicians. And in Chicago, they vote even when they're dead. You know. So I think the tactics and strategy is really important. I think that what we have, I think part of what our real struggle right now is to create a different kind of attitude and trajectory in our overall movement. To stop following in the wake. To stop following in the wake of those misleaders of our community. We have to create a new path and then set higher goals for the masses of the people to realize. And finally, and I think the question of isolating ourselves is really important. I don't believe in being isolated. I truly do not believe in being isolated, but I think that we can take this on without fear of isolation. I think things are changing in people's lives, and even people who call us up now who talk about how, you know, well, I might vote for him, but I'm really disappointed. History is teaching people's lessons, and we would make a serious mistake if a fear or a reticence to explain the conditions as they are in the world would keep us from attacking, you know, like these conditions, whether they're represented by Obama or anybody else. People were saying this when we were talking about Nelson Mandela. You know, our people left this, and liberals went on radio stations and condemned us because we called Nelson who he was, because we said the ANC who he was. Now, you know, more and more people are being able to see that. And unfortunately, he's probably going to die before he is exposed to them, you know, but history is on our side. So I want to thank you so much, and with your permission, what we'll do is close this discussion. And because this brother is a big brother who's holding up this time is up thing, he's been doing it quite, you know, deliberately over the last period. So I'm hoping that you can really think about this, and I'm hoping that there's going to be a kind of plenary session at the end of this discussion, this meeting on today, at the back end. We want everybody to also be thinking of, those of you who are going to be functioning panelists, come, you know, think of resolutions that you can offer for discussions in this meeting and for the steering committee to be able to vote on tomorrow. So I want to thank you very much and turn it back over to Secretary Aisha Fleer. Uhuru.
Uhuru. I really appreciated that overview, Chairman, and just all of the points of historical points that you presented in that piece as well. And I really enjoyed the discussion that came from the audience as well. So moving forward, we are going to have a panel discussion to include Glenn Ford and Nelly Belly, who is running a little late. The discussion in this section is about the bourgeois monopoly of the electoral process. And I'm going to introduce...